Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And welcome, Earth Explorers from all around the planet. We're here coming to you live from North Carolina. Our AccuWindow forecast, about 85 degrees and clear. The solar wind is a stout 310.5 kilometers per second, sunspot 1106, which is actually old sunspot 1100, is gaining new life and shows potential of C-class flares, so be aware of that. High-latitude sky watchers should be alert for auroras on probably tonight and tomorrow night. That's when a coronal mass ejection is expected to deliver a glancing blow to Earth's magnetic field. NOAA forecasters estimate a 30% chance of geomagnetic activity during the next 24 hours. The source of the incoming CME is a magnetic filament on the sun, which erupted during the late hours of September 10th. Shortly after the filament erupted, the plasma sea underneath it seemed to open a fiery red fissure. This is a common manifestation of explosions on the sun. In the aftermath of a flare, magnetic loops form over the blast site. Hot plasma sliding down the sides of these loops hits the stellar surface, creating a light show that resembles a parting of the Red Sea. There were an average of 23 quakes in the last 24 hours, with three of them larger than 5.0. They're between 40 and 175 kilometers below the surface of the Earth. Economists peddling dire warnings that the world's number one economy is on the brink of collapse amid high rates of unemployment and a spiraling public deficit are flourishing here. The guru of this doomsday line of thinking may be economist Nouriel Roubini, thrust into the forefront after predicting the chaos wrought by the subprime mortgage crisis and the collapse of the housing bubble. He says the U.S. has run out of bullets, as he told an economic forum in Italy earlier this month. Any shock at this point can tip you back into recession, he says. Boston University professor Lawrence Kotikoff unveiled a doomsday scenario, which many dismiss as pure fantasy, of an economic clash between superpowers, the United States and China, which holds more than $843 billion of U.S. Treasury bonds. By the way, the U.K. holds almost that much, Japan right behind it. He says a minor trade dispute between the United States and China could make some people think that other people are going to sell U.S. Treasury bonds, he wrote in the IMF's Finance and Development Review. That belief, coupled with major concern about inflation, could lead to a sell-off of government bonds that causes the public to withdraw their bank deposits and buy durable goods. We are bombarded by advice to do just that. There are at least five buy gold commercials an hour in the U.S. right now. Kotikoff warns that such a move would spark a run on the banks and money market funds, as well as insurance companies, as policyholders cash in their surrender values. In a short period of time, the Federal Reserve would have to print trillions of dollars to cover its explicit and implicit guarantees. All that new money could produce strong inflation, perhaps hyperinflation, he said. Gee, isn't that a little like what the administration is doing right now? printing money 24 hours a day? Interesting. Remind you that Remembering the Future is now available on Kindle. This is our first attempt at Kindle, so we're Kindle gardeners. So if you read books without using paper, you can do so by going to Amazon, looking for the book as a Kindle version, or by clicking the link at rememberingthefuturebook.com. We also have the link up at xsquaredradio.com. And the book went out in print in Amazon yesterday. So if you bought the ebook, we will send you a coupon code for 25% off. I'm working on the audio version this week. You'll get a copy of that as well. By the way, the ebook special is going to end next Sunday. So if you like ebooks, you can download it now. At least you get all the graphics that I created in color. And you also get 25% off the printed version, and you get the audio version. So it's a pretty good deal. Before we get to our guest tonight, I wanted to let you know that robotics has made a breakthrough. Scientists have actually made artificial skin. Biotech wizards have engineered electronic skin that can sense touch in a major step toward next-generation robotics. And they say prosthetic limbs. The lab-tested material responds to almost the same pressures as human skin and with the same speed. Important hurdles remain, but the exploit is an advance toward replacing today's clumsy robots and artificial arms with smarter, touch-sensitive upgrades, they believe. No, it's not Cyberdyne Systems, but it sure sounds like a lot of fun. We might have robots a lot smarter and a lot more able in our real world than you might think. We'll be back in 40 seconds, a couple more notes, and then our guest. We've got a very, very interesting subject matter tonight. Don't go away. 40 seconds more, X Squared Radio after this. As we head into hurricane season and then into winter, you're going to be traveling, you're going to be moving about the country. We want you to be prepared. Our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com have put together well-packaged, well-priced, and rapid shipping on emergency preparedness supplies. Don't be a burden on emergency support staff like FEMA and your local police, fire departments, and emergency response teams. Prepare yourself. Take care of your own. Take care of maybe a neighbor, some friends, your grandkids. 1-800-PREPARE.com. As we look out into space, it doesn't take much of a jump for us to realize, even mainstream people are now saying we're not alone. Now, what the nature of that not aloneness really is probably isn't very well accepted. Some people think that there are races living here on the Earth. Some people think we're being visited regularly by UFOs. Some people think that even ancient civilizations linger on in small numbers in high technology, sort of hiding just out of the view of people. I watched a video in preparing for tonight's program. Spanish fishermen out on the ocean, and they could hear jets overhead, and the jets peeled down to low altitude. Two jets flying in formation very, very fast. And ahead of them was another craft that they were chasing. And they got their video camera, started filming, and realized that the craft they were chasing wasn't from around here. And then all of a sudden, the craft turned down and dove straight into the water, making a huge splash. And the two jets went ripping across the sky above where that craft had gone in the water, and then, of course, tried to make a very high-speed turn, which takes a couple of miles for a jet. In the meantime, a military helicopter came down within 100 feet of the water and hovered around the same area. It was clear that this craft was being pursued, and these Spanish fishermen had caught it on film. Something is going on under the oceans of our planet. You know, the oceans make up probably pretty close to 5/7 the surface of the Earth. And yet we know very little about our oceans. We have our seaways that we travel, and ships have done this for hundreds of years, perhaps thousands of years. But most of the ocean is relatively untraveled. It certainly is unmapped. And beneath the waves, a few hundred feet, it's pretty mysterious to us. We don't have ships that can cruise down at 2,000 or 3,000 feet. And we have areas, most of the ocean is 3,000 or 4,000 meters deep, well below where we can detect. Now, we can surmise, we can take images from space, we can do infrared photography, we can do some sonar work. But I've got to tell you that sonar work is very difficult to do. You have to have your detector right down against the bottom. And there just aren't 3,000-meter-long cables that you can drag along the bottom and get reliable information. You can a few hundred feet, maybe even 1,000 feet, if the bottom is well known. It's been done off the coast of Cuba a little bit, down around 3,500 feet. But this only takes a swath of about a few hundred yards wide. Do you know how long it would take to map the sea floor a few hundred yards at a time? It's just not practical, which means our ocean floors are somewhat of a mystery to us. We don't really know what's down there. And if there are civilizations living here from other worlds, or old societies or civilizations left over from dynasties past, zeniths past, that's probably where they're sitting, because they're sure not sitting out on the plains of Kansas. They're not sitting out in the outback of Australia. They're probably underwater. And our guest tonight is an expert on that. He has collected probably more information about underwater bases and underwater civilizations, be they off-world or even secret government, than just about anybody else. I want you to welcome with me Richard Sauder. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you, Brooks. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you know, I'm so curious about this. X-Word Radio is a scientific talk radio program. At least that's the way we try to keep ourselves in the mainstream. And we have listeners from all over the world. Most listen by archive, but some are listening tonight live as far away as Japan and Australia and Wales and Canada and Florida and Mexico. And they're really curious about the subject, as am I. So I think this 3 hours is going to go very, very fast. Let's try to take the 10,000-foot view first. We'll just kind of go up above the Earth, look at the Earth from 10,000 feet, which isn't really that high. But we don't really know what's beneath the surface of our oceans and our world, do we?
Well, some things are known. We have to, first of all, I think, define our terms and start with the word we. What is meant by we? If you mean the general public, then yes. The general public, for the most part, has very little idea of what is beneath the sea, especially what is at great depth in the sea. However, I think if you were to be speaking about some of the world's intelligence agencies or leading oceanographic institutes, they would have a much better idea of what's down there. And I also believe in the case of some of the initiatic or secret societies that a great deal is known about the subterranean depths and the submarine depths, well above and beyond what would be true of the proverbial man and woman in the street.
Well, that is a really good observation. You're right. When I say we're talking about, you know, the guys down at the Charlotte Motor Speedway. I'm talking about the average person that watches History Channel or National Geographic Channel. They know the animated version of the world.
You're right. As far as that goes, most of those people believe that the attacks on 9/11, which are being much lauded and memorialized today, were actually carried out by crazed Arab terrorists on September 11th, 2001, when independent researchers have established very well that is not what happened at all. But what we saw was some kind of inside job, if you will, or false flag terrorist event carried out by government agencies of the United States and other governments. So if that's true, and it is, most people, meaning most average members of society, really live in a very sophisticated web or cocoon, if you will, of deceit, disinformation, misinformation, and very smug and snug and almost complete ignorance. So,
well,
yes,
I realize that you could probably make a case that you know, says, well, if they'll lie to us about this, they'll lie to us about everything.
And they will.
You know, I can give that the benefit of the doubt, but I have to ask the question sometimes. Do we or do we not really have a craft that can make a left-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour?
Well, again, this gets back to exactly whom you mean when you say we. Now, I have no doubt, based on my research, that yes, there are human factions on this planet who have crafts such as that. And I must tell you whom I believe those factions are. They would be very compartmentalized groups within the American military industrial aerospace complex. They would be perhaps relict human groups from Atlantean times or from the ancient Rama Empire in ancient India and Vedic times. They would perhaps be human groups that are on this planet, but who originated off the planet, either in the present time or in the past or in the future, but are here now, if you follow me. So there would be, in my estimation...
You know, I understand that, but we've talked about, and I'm sure you're familiar with, the idea that there's sort of a blending of the militaries around the world. There's really no U.S. military government complex. It's sort of U.S., China, German, Japanese, all kinds of secret elements, or shall I say extra military elements of many countries are involved in this.
Yes. Well, an answer to that question is yes and no. For example, you do have the Pentagon, for example, and then you have the Kremlin forces, and you have the People's Liberation Army in China, and so forth. And there is a great deal of in-house secrecy in those militaries, but you rightly observe, at a higher level, there is a great deal of cooperation between militaries across the planet. In the case of alliances such as the Shanghai Cooperation Council, or NATO, or other CETO, other military alliances and organizations such as that. At the same time, you have a certain amount of high-level sharing of technology and even strategy and tactics between putative enemies such as, or potential enemies such as, the People's Liberation Army and the Pentagon.
Going all the way back to World War II, where Germany and the United States collaborated very clearly on the atomic weapon that was used on Japan. All three countries were at war. And there were, you know, robber barons making money off both sides. We're clear on that. But
The Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe and the Kriegsmarine and the Gestapo and the SS did not collaborate directly with the United States Army and the United States Army Air Force and the United States Navy. That didn't happen, but there were industrialists on both sides who played both sides of the conflict. There's no
question
with that.
That's correct.
Yes.
So we have this.
When you come down to the present day, a case in point would be during the Clinton administration, there clearly was outright sharing or at least selling very sensitive military technology to the Chinese, especially as regards ballistic missile technology and also as regards very sophisticated high-speed supercomputer digital technology and that kind of thing. So, yes, this does go on, and at a very high level, you do find a certain amount of exchange of scientific and technological knowledge and expertise and personnel. And this has been going on for a very long time. It's clear that, as you observe, at a certain level, the game is rigged and fixed, and it is as if there's a very large, high-stakes game being played. And from my viewpoint, the ultimate game is control of the planet, the planet's resources, the planet's life forms, all of them, including the human race, by a very relatively small number of humans and perhaps other beings on the planet, off the planet and under the planet, beneath the surface, and exactly why they want to do that, exactly who these beings are, I'm not presently able to answer those questions.
Well, we've speculated on that from time to time. The Nephilim, the Anunnaki, the various latent races or even new races that are visiting the Earth and trying to dominate in one way or another, or even some that are here that are very benevolent and trying to save the world and keep us from proliferating nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction. Be that as it may, let's see if we can go from the ground up here. Let's just assume that these USOs or these undersea bases really do exist. And I would love it if you had some evidence, not evidence, but I know you can't do that on the radio. Here, look at this. No, I'm kidding. Some ideas about the legitimacy of real civilizations that might be living under the sea. And we do apparently have more comings and goings under the sea or in and out of the sea than we have on land. So what information do you have that you've learned or that you suspect about civilizations that might be sharing our planet that are not showing up at the local Walmart?
Yes. Well, you know, to tell the truth, they may be showing up at the local Walmart, too. And I will say that there's a good deal of witness testimony and experiencer testimony over a period of decades that indicates a good number of these so-called alien beings who are here are actually quite human in appearance. Indeed, they seem to be human, not necessarily from this planet in all cases. But it seems that some of them could indeed pass beside us in a Walmart or anywhere else without attracting undue notice. And I would surmise that a good number of them do go about in our society and are at large on the surface of the planet, unbeknownst to us usually. Now, as regards what's happening undersea, I can give you an example of what you can read and some of the kinds of things that you will hear, and that is there's a Puerto Rican ufologist named Jorge Martin, and he has a recent book that came out a few years ago entitled Vieques, Polígono del Tercer Tipo, And in that book, he deals with the great amount of reports of UFOs seen entering the waters around Puerto Rico and the many strange activities of the United States military in those Arctic, in those waters around Puerto Rico. One story that was related to him was by a man named Señor Roldán, who reported being taken by some humanoid-type beings. They're human-like, but they're not exactly as human in appearance as we are, but they are somewhat human-appearing. And they took him in a flying saucer type of vehicle under the water into the deep sea to a city that was on the seafloor to the east of Puerto Rico, thousands of feet underwater, where there was a great big transparent crystal type of dome on the seafloor with a futuristic type of city inside this dome. And they took him into this dome, and I spent some time there, and then returned. And there have been a number of stories like this over the years. That's just one I happen to know of because I read it in Jorge Martin's book. I do know Jorge Martin personally, and we've communicated many times over the years by letter, by email, over the telephone, and also in person. And I'm inclined to believe that that story may be true because there have been so many UFOs, or USOs, if you will, that have been reported coming and going from the seas, oceans, lakes, and rivers of this planet, really for centuries. This is not a recent thing. It's been going on for a long, long time as you look back into history and then coming down to the present day. So I would certainly regard the Caribbean area, including the waters around Puerto Rico, as an area of high likelihood for undersea bases, not only for other civilizations, but for our own, bases that could well have been built by the American Navy or by other technologically competent organizations, whether they be military, non-military governmental agencies, or corporate organizations.
Would have to think that if surface organizations are behind the construction of these bases under the water, that the civilizations that live there, the men and women and ostensibly children, whole civilizations that live there, would generally not blend with the surface dwellers anymore. They wouldn't just, you know, go on vacation at Disney World and that with everyone else.
No.
Because the reason that these bases are built is probably the main driver. I mean, look at the resources that they would have to marshal in order to build something underwater like that. The raw materials had to come from somewhere. The equipment had to come from somewhere. The money to build it had to come from somewhere. And the big question is, why? Why, when you could live perfectly well in Miami, would you want to live thousands of feet below the water off the coast of Puerto Rico? There has to be a good answer to that question. What's going to happen
to the
surface of the earth?
If you were from off the planet, you might not want to live in downtown Miami. You might want to live away from the madness of a large American city. Now, as for why, if you were human from this current civilization, why would you want to build an undersea base? There are several reasons I could think of. The military would have its own reasons for having secret deep sea submarine bases, for example, where they could take their crews and submarines and pool their men for weeks or months at a time in relative safety, security, and comfort. Another reason that I run across in the literature might be to make clandestine nuclear missile bases thousands of feet undersea. And there again, that would be done for reasons of of security, and also to have another arm, offensive arm, for fighting nuclear war in the event that there would be a nuclear war. In the book Silent War by John Pena Craven, who was the U.S. Navy's chief officer for their undersea warfare capability during the Cold War, Edward Teller, the father of the American H-bomb, asked discussed John Pena Craven putting nuclear missiles in silos in the seafloor 20,000 feet down, and doing that in glass nuclear missile silos, because glass, under very great pressure, such as you find in an extreme deep-sea environment, has extraordinary structural strength, far stronger than structural steel. So those are just two examples. Another example would be, for mining precious metals or other expensive commodities like uranium or plutonium or platinum or gold, or other rare earth metals, for example, which have a tremendous value, strategic value for industry, for the military, for commerce. And I can imagine if there were groups coming from off the planet who needed these materials, you might be able to exchange them for technology or information, and do this very secretly. For example, if you might hypothetically have a joint terrestrial, extraterrestrial, subsea mining facility. So those are the types of things you might do, considerations that might come into play. And if your only interest was to make money and you were an industrial tycoon, suppose you had your own private deep-sea plutonium mine or uranium mine that you could sell on the black market internationally to the highest bidder, or you had your own private gold mine or platinum mine. Imagine the kind of fortune you could make for that. Millions, maybe even billions of dollars. So that would be another reason for doing that. Other reasons that I have found in the literature are for scientific research. You could use such an installation for doing geological research or oceanographic research or research perhaps related to that NASA might find of value or interest for long-term space voyages. You could also use such a facility for an extremely secure command, control, and communication center for industry, for government, for the military. You could use such a facility for an extremely secure diplomatic base, where extremely powerful or high-profile individuals, whether in government or industry or high finance, could go and meet in complete secrecy and tremendous security without anyone knowing where they were or what they were doing. So those are just some of the reasons.
You could also consider the idea that, you know, Earth is pretty rare in our solar system for sure, but also in our corner of the galaxy. To be able to live on the surface of a planet, you have to have a very strong magnetosphere to protect you from the electromagnetic radiation from your sun. You've got to have the right temperature so that water is liquid. You've got to have the right oxygen content. These kinds of conditions are pretty rare, and you can't just travel space until you find a suitable planet. It might be out of the way. I would think most societies, most civilizations don't live on the surface of their worlds. They live inside their worlds. They live under the surface of their worlds. And so if a race were to come here to our planet, they might not be suitable or suited for existing on the surface of the world, where the temperature does all these wild extremes, where there are microbes multiplying by the trillions in all kinds of mutations, which would wipe out your race. It's wiped out a lot of our race from time to time. So it would make sense that they would create a somewhat sterile, isolated environment underneath the sea, away from the turmoils and conflicts, be they biological or social, on the surface of the world. It makes sense to me.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I don't know what the value systems would be of groups coming from off the world. I don't know what their biology might be. I don't know what their psychology might be. I don't know what their social or political or spiritual motivations might be. I don't know what their military agenda may be, if they have one. And I don't know what kind of alliances they might have, if any, with other entities or organizations or life forms on this planet or on other planets, in this galaxy or in other galaxies. You see, what we don't know, the things we don't know vastly exceed what we do know. So I don't know enough to really speculate intelligently about their motives or thought process. I only can say that certainly they will be different than we are, and most likely very different. Hence, they will be alien in many regards to us. And all I can say is they're likely to be bizarre, not necessarily malevolent, although some of them may be, I don't know. But it does seem that they are here. You know, Ivan T. Sanderson wrote a series of very interesting books decades ago. One of them was entitled Uninvited Residents. And in that book, he dealt explicitly with this very question that, and the book is about, I think, 50 years old, something like that. It's a classic. In that book, he dealt with this very question that over many years, repeatedly, these UFOs or USOs have been seen coming and going to and from this planet, seas, oceans, rivers, and lakes. One of the places he mentioned this has been observed with some frequency is Lake Erie, right here in the northeastern part of North America. And if you look at the geology underlying Lake Erie, it's really very favorable for tunneling and for making underground facilities, in this case, underwater, an underwater facility. Let me tell you why. There is a stratum of rock salt underlying a large area in the Great Lakes region, including under a large part of Lake Erie. And in fact, there are hundreds of miles of tunnels that go out from beneath the Cleveland area and go out under Lake Erie. Something on the order of 400 miles of these have been excavated. Yes, and they're about 1,700 feet down. So for years and years, there has been commercial mining of rock salt way deep below Lake Erie. This is offshore from Cleveland. So what I'm telling you is it would be comparative child's play for the Pentagon or any competent mining company in the United States to make a undersea base beneath Lake Erie. You don't have to posit exotic alien technology from light years away to make an underwater base beneath Lake Erie, because there are mining companies right here in the United States with the technological capability to do that, to tunnel out under Lake Erie. And there are men working under Lake Erie deep underground and have been for years.
Yeah, so that's geologically quite stable.
Yeah, so the question is there a secret undersea base of the science fiction-like sort beneath Lake Erie? Now, I have been told that there is, but, you know, people can tell you all kinds of things. What I can say is, number one, is it technologically feasible to make an undersea base beneath Lake Erie? The answer to that is yes, easily. Secondly, have UFOs been seen going to and from, coming to and from the waters of Lake Erie? Yes, many times over the years. Have I been told there is a secret undersea base, underwater base beneath Lake Erie. Yes, I did a radio show a couple of weeks ago where a man called in and said just that. He was from that area of the country, and he said there is a base, secret base beneath Lake Erie. Can I prove there is such a base? No. But if there are any people listening to this program who can, call in. We'd certainly like to hear from whistleblowers, and contact me, Kara Brooks-Agnew.
I'm down with that. Let's go ahead and announce the phone numbers right now. If you're off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, it's 530-413-4511. East of Earth, it's 530-413-4515. And west of Earth, 530-413-4520. Also, if you're going to leave during the broadcast tonight, you can listen to us live with your cell phone. Just call the number 712-432-0075. Put in the access code 318-116-POUND, 318-116-POUND, and you can listen to the entire broadcast via your cell phone. No problem. Just put your Bluetooth in and you can listen to us live. If you've got any information about underground bases under the sea of Lake Erie or anywhere else around the planet, we definitely want you to call in tonight and provide us some information if you found an opening. Now, I got to tell you, I was surfing a little bit today in preparation for the program, and I found a very interesting set of slides from someone who had used Google Earth on an area called the Dragon's Triangle. And he zoomed down, and I was pretty amazed. In the Dragon's Triangle, which looks to be about 2 miles long by a quarter of a mile wide, there are four or five large, clearly large circles, like structures, like concrete or you know, structures, not natural, that are just beneath the water. Now, the water where the Dragon's Triangle is only a couple hundred feet deep. This is really easy to see from space. And sure enough, they're there. So something's going on underneath the serene oceans of our planet. And it's not from around here, or maybe it is from around here, and these are just either modern civilization or ancient civilizations that want to live apart from those of us on the surface. Now, they may make forays into our society. I got to say, when you were talking about them showing up at Walmart, I was almost wanting to switch over to comedy because I promise I've seen some at Walmart. I really have. I didn't want to go up and ask him because it's sort of like, you know, asking a really heavy woman if she's pregnant. It's just not socially acceptable. But you really have to stare because, you know, you just wonder if they're hiding a tail under there or something. There are some mysteries going on this planet, and I have to express my extreme curiosity here because if they're there, why, you know, I have to continue to ask myself the question, why the resources spent by our governments? And I hesitate to even use the word governments because I'll tell you, Richard, I don't even think we have a government. I think we have a loose coalition of bureaucracies that share one big giant checkbook, and they're going to get away with it as long as they possibly can. But I don't think our elected officials even know what's going on. I think they have a small portion of the part of the government that shows up on the news channels, and the rest of it is buried. The rest of it is so far off camera that general public has no idea, and I don't think their elected officials have any idea what's going on. Something big is going on, and it's separate from those of us that are struggling paycheck to paycheck, family vacation to family vacation. They've got a completely different set of long-range goals for their society than we have for ours.
Yes, well, it's a vast planetary control structure that has been set in place. It is enormously funded. Look at these trillions of dollars that are being sucked out of the productive sectors of the economy and ask yourself where that money is going. We don't know. We, meaning the so-called proverbial, men and women in the street, the average Joes and average Janes. We don't know, but the money is being sucked out of the economy that we live in and is being funneled to other places, to other purposes, to other uses. Now, I would say that with regard to these structures that this fellow found using this Google Earth, was it you said?
Uh-huh.
You know, just because you find some large artificial-looking structure underwater doesn't mean that it's necessarily extraterrestrial, because the so-called conventional engineering capabilities that large corporations and major government agencies now have are in themselves very impressive. I would call your attention in that regard to the fact that the Navy, the United States Navy, the Chinese Navy, the Russian Navy, have the capability to make tunnels undersea that can accommodate huge ocean-going ballistic missile-firing submarines. Now, if you know how large these submarines are, they can be 500, 600, 700 feet long. They're mammoth, and they can be well over 100 feet from the top of the conning tower to the bottom of the hull, to the bottom of the keel, and with an impressive beam. So to make tunnels that can accommodate these types of submarines deep underwater or even at a shallow depth, the tunnels would have to be on the order of, 150, 200 feet in diameter so that these submarines can transit them safely. So it's possible. I could only speculate without seeing and having more information about what this gentleman discovered in his search online, but it's possible that he found the entrance to one or more of these undersea tunnels through which submarines can come and go. And they can enter these tunnels at sea and come on shore into underground submarine bases, very large submarine bases that could be miles inland.
Well, we've seen similar structures like that at the end of World War II in the somewhat warm water ports of Norway. The Nazis had built submarine bases back into the mountain with the entrances beneath the surface of the sea. They were just not visible from the sky. And these U-boats could enter these underground hangars or underwater hangars, and they could surface inside the mountain. And there was enough room in there for dozens of U-boats. These were very, very advanced complexes that were literally bomb-proof. And this is ostensibly the area that some of the upper leadership that had escaped during the collapse of Berlin made their way to and holed up in. And some of those U-boats evidently went underwater and ended up in Antarctica and in Brazil.
Yeah, well, the technology that exists today goes far beyond that. That technology is what 65 years old now. So what can be done today is an order of magnitude or more greater in scope and sophistication. Now, you mentioned what happened with respect to the Nazi high command at the end of World War II, or at least part of it, and there are many questions and mysteries about those events to this day. However, what is not in question is that the Nazis' number one underground base construction expert named Xaver Dorsch was captured or surrendered to the United States Army in the closing days of World War II and was in U.S. military custody for at least a couple of years and collaborated with them. They debriefed him, and it's no coincidence that beginning in the immediate post-World War II period, the period between 1945 and 1950, the United States military-industrial espionage complex began an intensive program of deep underground base construction that continues to this present day. So there was serious Nazi input from the Nazis' top expert from the very beginning. Now, during the war, the Nazis made a lot of underground facilities, quite a lot of them, and Xaver Dorsch was actually head of the Todt organization, T-O-D-T, which was founded by Fritz Todt. Fritz Todt was the creator of the German Autobahn system. He was really a brilliant civil engineer, and at the outbreak of war in the late 1930s, he was tasked by Adolf Hitler with creating a civil engineering agency, which is very similar to what we would know in our military system as the Seabees for the Navy or the Army Corps of Engineers for the Army. The Todt organization was like those organizations or agencies, except that it was a civilian agency that worked very closely with the German military during the Third Reich. Fritz Todt was killed in 1942 in a plane crash at the height of World War II. At that point, control of the agency, administrative control, effectively passed largely into Xaver Dorsch's hands. And by war's end, he was no longer reporting to Albert Speer, but had been commanded by Adolf Hitler to report directly to Hitler. And Hitler had him at work building a series of deep underground, large industrial production facilities. And, of course, the war ended, and that brought all of that to an end. But then Dorsch, as I mentioned, was taken into American military custody and was debriefed extensively by the American military. In fact, I have, and reproduce in my book, Hidden in Plain Sight, which I believe you have a link to on your website, books.
Yes.
But he, I have a couple of memos reproduced in that book from Project Paperclip, specifically asking for Xaver Dorsch and three other Nazi underground construction experts to be brought to the United States under Project Paperclip to work with the American military on their underground plant program. And this was circa 1947. So that's what was going on, and that's another aspect of Project Paperclip, which hadn't been previously publicized before my work, and I discussed that in my current book.
Well, you know, the economic structure of the United States is somewhat precarious right now. We know that private investment has it's a fraction of what it used to be. I'm not going to say it has completely evaporated, but I am going to say that venture capitalists, which are groups of predatory investors who take advantage of the poverty and scarcity of creative minds, lend them a little bit of money, just enough to get by, and then through their economic skills, ramp the company up to extremely high value in a very short amount of time, and then sell it. And that's how they make their money. And they don't really care if the technology or the company or any of the people that are working in the original technology even survive. That's the kind of investing that's going on in this country right now. Our government has been completely vacuous when it comes to investing in our small business. It might as well just say small business need not apply. That being said, you know, we're looking at the U.S. gross national product. We're looking at the amount of tax revenue that we're generating. We're looking at the amount of profit that American business is making and how it's being confiscated. And as a people, we're beginning to say, hey, what the heck's going on? Where did all the money go? Why is the United States broke? Why are the best economic minds in the world, and we read some of that news earlier tonight, why are they talking about the economic collapse of the United States? How in the world did we get in this shape? And what it appears to me, I see the same things happening to our country that happened to other countries prior to either a great leadership schism or a great war. We saw it with Germany as Germany separated from the banking community and post 1929 stock crash, post World War I, post Treaty of Versailles. All of a sudden, Germany emerges as this economic superpower, blitzkrieging its way militarily and economically across Europe. Unfortunately for Germany, well, at least at that time, we were still flying paper and dope biplanes when that war started. Now, because maybe military demands it, we develop our weapons at a much accelerated rate. But unfortunately for Germany, their supply lines were stretched out everywhere, from North Africa to Plasti to Austria, you know, ball bearing factories. Everything was visible from the air. Now it seems, at least according to what we're discovering here tonight on the program with you, many of these high-tech supply places are buried deep inside the earth, and they're not so easy to get to. It's as though preparations are being made, maybe not for war on just this planet, maybe in preparations for war between planets. It just seems like...
I have no idea. I have no information in that regard. And in fact, I would have to say, notwithstanding all of my research, there is a very high level of secrecy that's been clamped down on the entire field of secure underground and undersea bases. It's one thing to demonstrate that they exist, as I have, and to show the plans for their construction, as I have, and to indicate some of the corporations and agencies that are involved. It's another thing to say what is happening in a lot of these and exactly who is running them because of the extreme amount of secrecy. And so I cannot tell you with any degree of specificity what is happening in a lot of these installations. I can tell you that secrecy abounds. It's as if we have a parallel society, a parallel, extremely secretive, very high-tech society that feeds off of this society in which you and I live, Brooks, and presumably the vast majority of listeners to this program, and this other parallel, high-tech, extremely secretive society that is undersea and underground, feeds off of us, off of our money, off of our political energy, off of our ignorance, much like a vampire or a parasitic organism. Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, it would. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I realize, and I'm sure by the end of tonight's program, I'm going to be convinced that you're right. There are these large bases down there, but I'm also convinced that it took trillions of dollars to build them. And it took surface resources to go there and build those things underwater. Somebody knows about it.
Absolutely. It took a lot of resources to do that. And not only that, but a great deal more. I have another book that just came out this year, this spring, entitled The Richard Sauter Briefing. And in that book, I cover some of these issues, not only of the underground bases, but the question of a secret space program, for example. There is a body of evidence that strongly points in the direction of a large, you could even say vast, transnational secret space program for which NASA and the European space agencies, for example, are just dog and pony shows.
I think that's a wonderful idea, Richard. Let's talk about that right after the break. We'll go ahead and take a 2.5 minute break, let people get a glass of water, let our affiliates do what they're going to do, and we'll be right back with more Richard Sauter on X Squared Radio. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
That's the Alice Band singing the Neil Young classic After the Gold Rush. I just want to be sure that you know you can go to 1-800-PREPARE.com. And by the way, when you check out with your emergency preparedness supplies, either a 72-hour kit, go there, check it out. All kinds of amazing things that you can package in a small book bag, put near the front door of your house in a closet, grab and go, or put it in the trunk of your car. A lot of these supplies will last up to 25 years. You never have to give it another thought because you are prepared. As you check out, put in the coupon code Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, and get an extra 10% off. 1-800-PREPARE.com. Tonight on X Squared Radio, we're talking about undersea and even underground bases that have been built around the world. And it's evident because when we look around our economic structure globally, there's a lot of money missing. There's a lot of money missing. I'm talking a significant portion of the global gross national product that's missing. And it's clear, at least to the general populace and certainly to researchers like our guest Richard Sauter, that something is going on here. Secret bases, secret construction projects are being built. In this hour, I want to go ahead and finish up the discussion of undersea and underground bases on Earth, just by asking the question, Richard, what corporations in modern times, in today, in the 21st century, what corporations are working on these kinds of underground and undersea technologies. Who's involved? Ostensibly, it can't be everybody's secret. It can't be a completely separate society. There's got to be somebody with kids and mortgages and all that working on this stuff. Do you have any ideas?
Oh, sure. Some of the tunnel boring machines, that companies that I could name off the top of my head would be the Robbins Tunnel Boring Machine Company of Yelm, Washington, rather, Y-E-L-M, in Washington State. There's the Lovat Tunnel Boring Company. Those would be a couple of the better-known ones. And mind you, tunnels can be bored deep underground as well as deep undersea, beneath the seafloor. One way you can do that is to just start boring a tunnel on shore, on land, maybe 1,000 feet down, 2,000 feet down, and just bore straight out to sea and go out under the seafloor, under the seabed, down in the bedrock. It's technologically not really any more difficult to head out to sea than to tunnel inland. Now, as far as some of the companies that would be involved in making underground bases or undersea bases, Parsons, Brinkerhoff, Quaid and Douglas, the Bechtel Corporation, another one that comes up is a Jacobs company, Jacobs Engineering, Kiewit, K-I-E-W-I-T. So these are some of the ones that I could name right off the top of my head, and they come up. Black and Veatch, or Black and Vetch, however you pronounce it, V-E-A-T-C-H, of Kansas City or St. Louis, anywhere there in the Midwest. So there are quite a number of these companies whose names appear over and over in the literature. That gives you an idea. Those are some of the major ones.
There are people that work for these corporations, and they own homes and buy cars and, you know, pay for college educations and build equipment. Do they know what the equipment's being used for? I mean, do they see it disappear off the coast of Rhode Island and turn up in Paris?
Well, in some cases, they absolutely know what it's used for. You have to understand that in the military-industrial espionage complex, that it's routine for technicians, engineers, scientists, administrators to have high-level security clearances when they're working on sensitive, compartmentalized projects, on secret programs. And so, yes, they would know in many cases what is being done, and they would be sworn to secrecy with severe penalties for violating their security agreement. So, sure, there would be thousands of people.
But these are human beings, and they have mental problems, and they have guilt trips, and they get terminal illnesses and want to make deathbed confessions and diaries. Somebody somewhere is going to leak this information out. We've got a caller on line one. Robin, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I have a few questions for you. It's very, to me, okay, I understand that what you guys are saying is there's underground bases and under the ocean, and they're digging under the ocean, and honestly, there are better places on this earth. Antarctica would be one of them, where you wouldn't have to go and you still get the secrecy, but, you know, and they're very remote, and you wouldn't have to go under 5 miles of ocean, which is really difficult to deal with, even if you are digging, even if you do have the best technology to move. I can see where you'd want to mine something, but that would be a heck of an operation, too. Now, if you were doing this for long periods of time, because it would appear that these people who you're talking about, if they are who you're talking about, and they're the ones that were depicted in ancient Egypt in that, they're 12 feet high, tall. They're not our size. So they're not going to walk around on an earth, you know, and we're not going to, like, not notice them at Walmart. But even if they did, if they're living underground, their skin tone, their pigments would change. It would be a lot of distortion. It would be very noticeable. They would look remarkably different. So, I mean, to live under those conditions, to live under that kind of pressure, and then to come on the surface after, you know, years of being under there, and it's dark. I mean, there's no light. I mean, you get down a few miles, you've got pitch blackness, you know, and it's, yeah, you could have neon or a type of fluorescent lighting kind of effect, but that's nothing like sunlight is. So the
well, let me debunk all of these objections one by one. Number one, if you read the literature, for example, from the U.S. Navy's Rock Site document from 1966, that's almost half a century ago, it quite clearly states that even then, the United States Navy had the ability, using existing technology, to make deep undersea bases down in the bedrock with one atmosphere pressure. In other words, a short sleeve environment. So it's simply not true that when you go down into an undersea base thousands of feet down that the pressure is higher. It's a controlled climate, controlled environment. And the pressure is not higher. The pressure would be just the same as it is at the surface of the Earth. So that's number one. Number two, you're dealing with sophisticated, advanced technology. So there would be provisions made, and there are in these closely contained bases for sustaining human life over the long term and healthfully so, using special lighting. Special air conditioning equipment. They even can put hydroponics down there, and I've been told this is the case in some facilities. So the hydroponics scrub the carbon dioxide out of the air, and they provide breathable oxygen in return. And in terms of people not looking the same, well, you know, a great deal is known about nutrition nowadays, and thanks to the deep undersea submarine program and also the space program, we know how to put people in enclosed environments for very long periods of time and sustain them healthily. So all of these objections can be met and can be handled. And there's quite a bit of knowledge and engineering behind it.
Let me interrupt. That's wrong. In space, you can't do that. They've got a 6-month limit.
Yeah, but
these people come back.
We're not talking about, under space here. We're talking about being on the Earth under a 1G environment in a breathable atmosphere. And
yeah,
in terms
can't
of
move and walk. Are they exercising or doing gyms?
I don't know.
You've got an enclosed environment.
Give me a chance to respond. And in terms of ancient Egyptians, I don't know if there are ancient Egyptians underground, number one. And if they are, they wouldn't be ancient. I don't know that there were 12-foot beings in ancient Egypt. This is an allegation you have made. All the information that I have indicates that 5,000 years ago, Egyptians were the same size as people are today.
It's in the hieroglyphs. You'll see them. They're 12 feet high. It's everywhere. It's the Sumerian tablets, the cuneiform text. It's all there. They're 12 feet high, 10 to 12 feet high. It's not an allegation. You can see it in the record. And this record is there for everyone.
We're not talking about ancient societies. We're talking about modern corporations. We're talking about Bechtel and Parsons and Jacobs going down and building these bases and regular Navy personnel occupying
what's
them.
The motivation? Okay, so what's the motivation, guys? They want to blow up the
Earth? Yeah, if you listen to the program in the first hour, I spelled out in detail some of the motivations, which the Navy, by the way, and other agencies
you can take money out of the plant on the surface
in their documents.
But you can make money on the surface. You can mine on the surface of the planet. You can make money on the Earth. You don't have to go down. You can mine with everybody knowing you. I mean, we have oil wells. Everybody knows about in the Gulf. We extract oil from there and we make money from it.
You may disagree with the reasons that the Navy has given in the published documentation or other agencies and organizations. All I can do is tell you that I have official documentation from the United States Navy and also from the Stanford Research Institute, which was affiliated with Stanford University at one time, is no longer, but still exists. And they enumerated military, scientific, and industrial reasons for making dozens of deep undersea manned bases, and this was as of, 40 years ago. So you may object to their stated reasons, however, they are there in the literature, and I can't tell you more than that. If
and
you don't like
the
it...
the purpose is to protect... I'm trying to find the purpose out, honey. You're not...
Well, we talked about that.
Well,
may I suggest you purchase my book, and you can read the reasons in detail. I spell them out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and... I don't know what more I can tell you than that.
Military operations for defense, or is this a regular mining operation that,
if you were listening to the program in the first hour, I detailed all of this point by point, and answer your questions is yes. Military reasons,
mining
reasons.
I did listen
mining
to it,
reasons,
but I couldn't hear you. You were vague. You were saying, well, there's somebody who said this, and they did this, but we don't know why exactly they did
Robin,
that. We don't
Robin,
know
Robin,
why,
Robin,
what I heard you say.
Peace, all right? What we're trying to do is understand. We understand maybe why they were built. Maybe we're expecting some surface calamity, or we need ultra security, or some of these military complexes can be quite paranoid, and they want to be sequestered from the surface of the world. Maybe they think something terrible is going to happen on the surface, and they need somebody somewhere to survive. Maybe they've been asked to do it by very, very high leadership in order to build an area where they can survive.
But don't you think that sounds a little psychotic? I mean, do we have really people that estranged from reality running?
Yeah, I think so. I mean,
the
Bilderbergs meet every year. They're pretty psychotic as far as I'm concerned.
Let me tell you, for a long time, the announced policy of this country for waging nuclear war was mad. May I submit that mad is a psychiatric term that we apply to people who are psychotic. If someone is psychotic, we say they are mad, and that was the announced military doctrine of this country for decades. Mutual assured destruction by thermonuclear warfare. So, yes, ma'am, that is psychotic.
Yeah, I agree.
It's terribly so. Well, under these conditions, I mean, how did you get involved, can I ask you this, in exploring this, and what is your background? I mean, how did you initially start out and start informing yourself about it, start learning about this stuff? How did that happen for you?
Well, I heard people talking about alleged underground bases and tunnels, so I went straight to the military literature, technical literature, and industrial corporate literature, and began to do a methodical search for information, and I hit pay dirt. I continue to find information. I've had people who have talk to me privately off the record, including some who are in the uniform military services, some who are retired from them, some who work for other government agencies, some who work for the military in a civil capacity, some people from so-called ordinary walks of life who never worked for the military or any government or corporate agency, but had information from other sources and by other means, and I've had just a lot of people come forward. Many of them quietly, very few of them want to go publicly on the record. I will say that one of them who did was a gentleman named Walter Kirshner, and I have Walter's illustrations in my book, Hidden in Plain Sight. Walter Kirshner, back in the 1960s, was attached to a United States Navy research and design team at China Lake, what was then China Lake Naval Ordnance Test Station out in the desert in California. near the Nevada line. And the China Lake Navy base station still exists today. It has always been involved in cutting-edge research and design for military technology, was then, still is. But at that time, there was an R&D team that was formed at China Lake specifically for developing or doing the R&D work for deep undersea manned Navy bases in mid-ocean, down in the bedrock beneath the seafloor. And Walter Kirshner was the illustrator that the Navy hired to work on that project. I was doing the radio interviews a few years ago, and Walter Kirshner happened to hear me and contacted me after the interview and said, you know, I worked for the Navy back in the 1960s, and here's what I did. Would you like to know more? I said, sure. So he ended up giving me a lot of the illustrations that he'd done for the Navy then of the plans they had for making huge submarine bases in mid-ocean, actually down in the bedrock beneath the seafloor, where they would bring in, you know, six or more ocean-going ballistic missile-firing submarines at a time and berth the submarines there undersea. The crews would be taken off of submarines and would live in some degree of creature comfort deep undersea, and they would have nuclear missile silos down there undersea as well. And these were the Navy plans as of almost half a century ago. I have been told that facilities like this have been made. Clearly, I am not in the Navy. I don't have a security clearance. I have not been into such facilities, but the totality of what I've been told and the documentation I've assembled, not only from Walter Kirshner, but from other sources and other individuals, indicates that that almost certainly has been done. But no, I don't work in the Navy, and if I did have such a security clearance, I couldn't tell you so over the radio either. So that is one way I found out what I know.
But, you know, I have a nephew who works in intelligence, too, in the military. And the truth be known, they all tell the family members what's going on. They're not as secret as you think. They say, well, and the family members are usually very good about just keeping it among themselves. But, you know, at some point, you know, when it's not an issue, they'll tell someone else and tell someone else. And it kind of, it's like they're handed, but the information kind of gets out there that this is kind of going on. You know, it's
yeah.
That's right, and that's why we're talking about it over the radio. Now, you may not believe it. That's fine.
Well, it's not that I don't believe it. It just makes sense that you can do this. I understand if you were doing this for defense, okay, and the military would do sort of like an Area 51 thing, and you're doing an underground, we're still aware of Area 51, but, you know, we really don't know what goes on there. And there's some bases in Utah and other areas in the United States, too, that we're not really, we know they're there, we just don't know what they do there. The thing is that if you, the underground, this is the first I've heard of the bases underground, and
well,
it seems like we have some kind of a, you know what I mean,
May I suggest that you get all my books
for a long time. I mean, that's a major operation. They're doing a lot of gearing up, a lot of companies.
Get all of my books in and read them and inform yourself. I have far more information in detail written in hundreds of pages than I can possibly cover in a relatively short amount of period on the radio.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate it, and I'll listen on. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call, Robin. I think we have Martin on line two. Is Martin still out there?
Yes, Martin is here.
All right. All right. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, sir, for taking my call. First, I'd like to throw in a few things. All this proof talking about underground bases and just all the time to build this, will we ever know about it? Who knows? You guys are talking about over in Egypt, 12-foot tablets. There's proof? Yeah. Who the hell else talks about it? Who else is going to come forward to all of us and let us know what the hell is going on? Is this going to be like, you know, like 2012 hit us and we all got to go underground and survive and talking about lights and everything? You know, we have all of our troops over in Afghanistan fighting for our rights and everything. Don't you think they would be using all the army people to go down underneath the base and get all everything going if this is really true?
Well, if the army was going under the base, I think everyone would agree with me. We'll never find out about it.
Yeah, I mean, what is this going to be like? Willy Wonka handing out a ticket to go underground to survive? How many of us are going to die? What's going to go on?
You know, that's a really good question.
May I answer your question? I actually know the answers to some of the questions. Number one, in terms of so-called continuity of government facilities, COG facilities, of which there are a good number underground in this country, there are actually cards that are given out to individuals granting them access. They are so-called JEEP cards. J-E-E-P is the acronym. It stands for Joint Emergency Evacuation Program. And if you have a JEEP 1 card, you have priority access. Someone will be sent you some conveyance, a fast car, or a helicopter, something like that, to take you to your designated underground base. If you have a JEEP 2 card, you still may gain entrance, but you are not a priority person, in that a helicopter or something like that would not be sent to ferry you over to the underground facility. So if you are not the possessor of either a JEEP 1 or JEEP 2 card, you may presume there will be no room for you in the inn in an emergency situation, and you will not have a space in a secret underground base. Now, there are many such bases. There's one under the White House. There's a mammoth underground facility deep beneath the White House in Washington, D.C. There's one beneath the Pentagon. There's one at so-called Site R, or Raven Rock, which is a major, large, deep underground base on the border between Pennsylvania and Maryland. There is a huge base. Let me finish. There's a huge base beneath Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. There's a huge base.
The damn Bible. Who knows?
I'm telling you, I know. Will you let me finish, please?
I know those bases are there.
There is a deep base at Camp David that sprawls for miles in the mountains of Maryland. There are major workings underground in Nevada beneath Area 51, for example. There is a vast base in the mountains of New Mexico and the Manzano Mountains to the southeast of Albuquerque. There are underground workings at the White Sand Missile Range, also in New Mexico. There are large underground installations elsewhere in Nevada running in the region of the S-4 and over toward California in the desert. And so there are many of these facilities all over the country. There are many federal centers. There's one, for example, in Buffalo, Washington. There's one in the Denver Federal Center, west of Denver, out toward the Front Range of the Rocky Mountains between Alameda and Sixth Avenues in the western part of the Denver metropolitan area. So there are many, many underground facilities all over the country.
Okay, well, say if there are those places. So you're basically telling me if I don't have a JEEP card, we're all screwed, right?
I'm saying you're screwed.
Not necessarily. You'll have to survive on the surface of the planet. And that's kind of, you know, the whole idea about the secrecy and the money that's being used to put these things together, that there has to be some kind of a survivor group, and not unlike, you know, what we see in science fiction movies. Really, not unlike that at all. But obviously, there's not enough room for 7 billion people to make it into such a facility. Now, the conspiracies can fly as to whether it's going to be an asteroid or a weapon of mass destruction. But I grew up, you know, crawling underneath my school desk once a month as a practice for a thermonuclear war in Southern California. That's the kind of environment we grew up in. And,
I can tell you, I did. And in the literature I've seen, I looked into the nuclear war literature a fair amount in the past years, and the documentation I saw indicated that in the event of an all-out nuclear war, that something on the order of 140 million Americans would be killed. I think the average person cannot wrap their mind around the horror of thermonuclear warfare and how horrific and apocalyptic the destruction would be. So, yes, some people would survive, but I would submit that if you had an all-out nuclear war, that it would be far more hellish than practically any of us can imagine.
I think we have some pretty stupid world leadership, and we have a lot of saber-rattling, and we have a lot of banner-waving, but I don't think there's anybody stupid enough or crazy enough to involve themselves in all-out global thermonuclear war. Maybe a terrorist act. Maybe one or two warheads get in the hands of terrorists, but not what we were thinking about in the 60s, about launching thousands of warheads at each other. That is just unthinkable.
Well, we still have those thousands of warheads is the point. I think the United States, from my reading, has something on the order of 3,500 active nuclear devices ready to go in the form of air-launched cruise missiles from B-52s, from ballistic missiles fired from land silos and also from submarines, from airdropped nuclear weapons. We still have thousands of them, Brooks, ready to go.
Well, that's true. I realize we have thousands of them
ready
to
go. Where are we going to relocate to? What would be the safest place for us to stand and try to get try to live? What are we going to do?
That's a really good question, Martin. I like the question. I think, for one, I was stationed at Grand Forks, North Dakota when I was in the Air Force, and that was target numero uno because of all the missile silos that were around. We had probably double warheads targeted on our base over any other base in the world. So I would say the safest place to live would be as far away from a military installation as you could get, especially one that had missiles or B-52s stationed at it.
You know, exactly. I mean, say we all sit here. When is this going to come? We all don't know when it's going to come down on us. Nobody's telling us anything. The Navy, everybody's into it. We hear comments and stories and radio stations like this. Do we all know it's true? Is everybody just talking a lot of crap, or do we actually believe what everybody's saying?
No, we're not talking a lot of crap. What we have is evidence that trillions of dollars have been spent preparing these bases. As Richard has said tonight, we don't really know why. We don't have the why reasons. We just have the evidence that they are there. And we can speculate as to why. And I understand your frustration. I get frustrated as well because I'm a small businessman, and I'm sure there are thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of small business people just like me who are wondering, where did all the investment money go? Where's all the money? Where's all the gold? Where's all the cash that we generated 300 years of gross national product of the most productive country on the planet? Why are we broke? That's a really good question.
Well, you think about the Army signs everybody up and gives them all. My brother's got a good $300,000 wrapped up into him. He has a security clearance, but yet he doesn't speak of any of this underground tunnel or living or how long can we actually survive underground without going to the surface to get exactly what we need.
That's a good question, Richard.
These underground facilities are not intended for the ordinary person. That's the point. And whoever is working in them underground, if your brother's not underground, okay, he's not. But there certainly are many people working underground. I can tell you, I've spoken with whistleblowers, and I've been told forthrightly there are many underground bases, and there are thousands of people working in them. There's no doubt about that. The truth is that we live in a mind-controlled society. We live in a society where information is controlled. We live in a society that's very tightly compartmentalized. We live in a society where we, the people, are being mugged. We are being ripped off money is being stolen from us by the billions and trillions of dollars. And in terms of the military, it's true that the United States military is, more money is spent on the United States military every year than on all of the rest of the militaries on the entirety of the rest of the planet combined. So where is our money going? A lot of it is going into this huge military machine that the United States has. Why does the United States have such a huge military machine? And if it's to preserve our freedom, why are we being mugged by the United States government?
Yeah, freedom from whom? What army are we going to face? I can tell you, a relic, if you really want to see a relic, it's got to be a military uniform. We don't fight people in military uniforms anymore. We don't fight people with tanks and airplanes and all that. That's not the way we fight war now. There's no army going to come up on the coast of the United States of America. There's no reason why we have to spend $1.3 trillion a year on national defense. Defense against whom?
Maybe defense against our own selves. What are we all getting ourselves into?
That's a good question. That's really good questions. I like the way you're thinking on that. This is how we hold our politicians' feet to the fire. But how do you hold a bureaucrat's feet to the fire? What do? You can't get in the Pentagon and ask them questions. You can't go knock on the door of Wars R Us at the Pentagon and say, what the heck are you guys preparing for?
Totally understandable. You know, all this money going everywhere and all these beliefs in different places, you know, I hope everything works out for us, because that's a pretty, you know, scary thought of the world ending and going underground and possibly the chance of not getting underground. And then we're all stuck outside and surviving what happens to the earth.
Yeah, I understand. I saw I think it was a Twilight Zone episode just like that. Somebody had built or spent their money on building their shelter, and the neighbors spent their money on boats and vacations and fancy equipment in their house. And sure enough, the threat came and the radio announcement was made, and the one family got in their shelter with their food supply, and the other family came over to try to break in. And it was this whole social breakdown that Rod Serling was really trying to portray there. It was kind of interesting. But I hear your energy. I really I sense your frustration with it, Martin. And what I'm hoping, and I think what Richard's hoping too, is that we never have to use these underground facilities. That somehow we will figure out how to live with one another on the surface of this most amazing planet so that we don't have to go underground.
Well, Brooks, the thing is, and it gets back around to who we are again. You and I are not underground and likely will not be, and neither the cores are underground and likely will not be either. However, you know, the horse is already out of the barn on this issue. There already are myriad underground bases, large underground bases. They are staffed. They have people living in them, carrying out projects and programs that we don't know about. So whether or not you hope this will never be done, it already has been done. With your money, with behind your back, under your feet. And we truly do not know, in many cases, what is happening underground and undersea. And it is this secrecy and the fact that trillions of dollars are being sucked out of the economy, used for projects and programs that we don't know about and we're not being told about. All of this greatly bothers me.
Well, maybe those guys should get their Jeep 1 and Jeep 2 cards, get in their Jeeps, and go underground and leave the rest of us alone.
I like that thought. Well, thank you for taking my call, guys.
Appreciate hey, thanks, Mark. Thanks for calling. And, call back again sometime.
All righty. Thank you, sir.
Well, okay, we have one more call here. Bob from Arkansas, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Agnew, and hello to Dr. Sauter.
Hello, yourself.
You know, I had to call in and share this because the previous two callers, I can go back about 8 or 9 years ago. The first time I heard this type of information, I really struggled with it. In fact, I turned off several shows. But then something happened about 5 years ago where I had to get deep within myself, and finally I had to admit, hey, you know what? Maybe I just haven't been told the truth on a lot of these subjects. So what I did is I threw everything out the window, stuff I was willing to argue with the neighbor about and such, you know. And once I did that and my heart opened, the information that has come since has just been remarkable.
Well, share a little bit of it with us.
Well, you know, it's nothing that I can prove. Okay, and you know, these things are difficult to prove, but I've had, I don't call them a dream, because a dream, my normal dreams are kind of chaotic. They're, you know, I'll be in one place one moment and another place, you know, a split second later. But I've had a couple of these dreams where I'm in a place and, there's not that chaotic, you know, disappear and show up somewhere else and what have you. Well, in this place is I've actually, the first time is I've met, I can't remember what we were talking about, but I met a half dozen guys with long beards that were 12 to 15 foot tall. And there was no fear in this dream at all. And I woke up right after, a split second after the dream, and I couldn't remember what we were talking about. But I do remember that there was no fear involved. Well, some amount of time after that, maybe 7 or 8 months later, I was in a place that, now I find this really interesting, especially with Dr. Sauter talking about the underground or underwater bases and the usage of glass. This building I was in had partitions like a normal office type building, but it was all glass walls. And there were such a different types of people. The people that met me first was an elderly lady that had maybe an inch over 5 foot if she was lucky. And as I walked through this place, I met people that were 6 foot all the way up to 8 foot. And dressed kind of like we are today. Now, going back to the bearded guys, my first dream with the tall people is they were dressed much differently. I would say kind of like swashbuckler type clothing, you know, from from years past. But the most recent one I had was these guys. They dressed just like us. And as I walked through this facility, you know, some of the guys were literally 8 foot tall, and all the way down to the lady that first greeted me, she was, you know, 5 foot. But I did notice that there was no fear, you know, no fear in these types of dreams. Now, getting back to what I was saying about the previous two callers and, you know, struggling with this information, is I found myself that once I was willing to admit to myself that, hey, I just, maybe I don't know what I think I know. That was the start. And then, you know, I do a lot of prayer. Some people might call it meditation, but it is it's a prayer. And I ask for information. And the remarkable thing about it is the last 4 years or so is I get information and it is always true. And it's like a synchronicity of events is I'll wake up from a dream and go, oh, wow, you know, kind of like an epiphany. And then in the next few days or a few weeks, there will be these little signs that'll pop out and confirm what I had had in the dream. It's hard to explain, but I think
I understand. I get a lot of people that, you know, fairly scientific people who are not getting information through their instruments per se, but they're getting experiences. They're getting like downloads. They're getting complex information. Some of it formulas or machine designs, things like that through dreams, just like what you're talking about. I had one lady tell me not long ago that she dreamt about a huge underground base under the Denver airport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I've heard stories of that, too. And I have listened to Mr. Sauter for, you know, a few years now. And I do believe there is 130 bases, you know, here in the United States, or DUMs, or deep underground military bunkers, whatever they're called. And I'm sure it's worldwide, too. You know, and this government situation where, you know, if we're waving the flag over here and the Russians are waving the flag over there, I don't believe any of that. They're all in on this information together. And as far as the intelligence agencies and all that, they all work together. There may be surface spats from here to there, and maybe on.
I think Bob's phone is running out of battery. We might have to let Bob go from Arkansas. I really appreciate the call, Bob. And
okay,
please call back.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Bob, your phone's cutting out a little bit. We're gonna have to let you go. I got another caller on the line. I really appreciate the call. Please call back again. Appreciate it. Jason from Nevada on line 3. Welcome to the program. Jason from Nevada, are you there? Well, Richard, are you still here?
Yes, sir, right here.
Okay. You know, it's clear that a lot of people are aware of these military installations, we'll call them, or underground bases are out there, but they're kind of frustrated. I hear it in their voices that they're frustrated that only the command and control, only the military or those that have these jeep cars you're talking about are going to be allowed to occupy these areas. And, of course, I can see from an organizational standpoint the reasoning behind it. I mean, look at the chaos that we would have if we had, 1,600 Christian religions and all kinds of other religious forces to deal with. What if all that piled in underground? Then we'd have a real social mess. I would see that you have to have some kind of structure and order, and everybody's got to have a job. They got to do something that supports the organization.
Well, let me say, first of all, I want to disabuse you and your listeners of a number of ideas. Number one is that all of these bases are military. No, they are not all military.
Ah.
There are other organizations and agencies underground, some known, some unknown. I have never, in my writings, my interviews, my articles, books, etc., maintained that it is only the military underground and undersea. No, others are there as well. Number two, it is not just, there are more types of facilities than just continuity of government facilities that are intended for use in the event of emergencies, whether they are military emergencies or natural catastrophes. There are a multiplicity of types of undersea and underground bases. They have multi-purposes. One facility might have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 purposes. In addition to multiple levels, a facility may have multiple agencies involved. There may be more than one nationality involved. there may be different levels of technology involved. Some of these facilities may be industrial facilities, may be military facilities, may be facilities for storing precious metals or money. Pardon me. They may be intended for the storage of government or business records. They may be intended for biological or genetic research. Pardon me. They may be intended for, in some cases, for prison facilities or for, you see, many other uses, for diplomatic facilities or for other purposes that remain unknown and unguessed at by me, by you, or by your listeners. So a great deal is unknown, you see. There may be cutting-edge research, design, and production facilities, as at Area 51, for example. And in reality,
we don't really know who operates Area 51. No U.S. government agency has ever admitted to operating that facility. For all we know, it's run by a non-governmental agency, perhaps by an agency from off the planet. We simply do not know. So you see, there are many unknowns here. What I can do and have done in my research is to document the location of numerous underground facilities, not all of which are military, by the way, and not all of which are necessarily operated by the American government, whether military or non-military agency.
Yeah,
so there
I got
more than
you.
There's more than one actor underground. It's far more than just the American military.
Well, one of our loyal listeners is in Japan right now. Ramon, welcome to the program.
How you doing, gentlemen?
We're doing really well.
Well.
It's early morning in Japan.
It's about 10:49 a.m. Had my coffee already. I want to ask you a question. Is your expertise more in military? Underground bases, human-made, or do you also research in things like ancient cities, for example, like the one in Mount Shasta?
I don't know if there's anything inside Mount Shasta. For one thing, I would observe that Mount Shasta is a volcano, and it has erupted in comparatively recent times. I don't think all of the volcanoes in the western region of North America are subject to erupt again. If I were to build an underground base, I'm not sure that I would build it inside of a volcano. So I personally...
I agree with that. 100%.
Say that there is an underground base inside Mount Shasta. I have never seen any hard documentation of an underground base inside Mount Shasta.
Okay. The reason why I asked that question, I'm sorry, Brooks, was because I've seen, and I don't know if Brooks has seen it himself, up in Mount Adam, which is also an ancient volcano to my knowledge. I could be wrong. But I've definitely seen a doorway open there, and I don't know if Brooks was there the day I was there that when it opened up. You see a light, and this mountain's 13 miles away from where we were at, and you can see a light. And in order for that kind of light to shine 13 miles away, it would have to be at least a 20-kilowatt light to be shining that bright.
I have seen the light, too. It's 13 miles away, and you can see sort of like, well, it's at night, but you can see a door open up, like a garage door. And it's a very bright light that shines out. And there's no roads there. I mean, there's no roads on this side of the mountain. It opens, it shines for maybe 10 or 15, 20 seconds, and then it closes.
If you are 13 miles away, how can you see something the size of a garage door?
Well, I'd say it opens like a garage door. It's like hangar size.
Okay. How did you see this? With binoculars, your bare eyes, or how?
Bare eyes and binoculars and infrared goggles.
Yep, night vision.
Okay.
And the more amazing part is not the doorway so much, is that you see actual quote-unquote satellites, which, of course, they're not, go into this mountain and then disappear.
Well, what do you mean by satellites? Because satellites orbit the planet.
Exactly. Well, that's what a skeptic would call it. You see these lights that look like satellites flying over. And they'll make sharp turns, and then they'll go in. Sometimes you'll see them go into the mountain.
Yes. Well, maybe so. If you can provide some hard evidence of that in the form of photographs, or, I mean, can someone just hike in there and look at the place? Why remain 13 miles away? Just hike right up to the mountain and with a telescopic camera lens and take some clear photos. This should be easy to do if people are observing this.
I could tell you exactly where I go, where me and Brooks went. It's a place called East SETI.
I don't have the means what I'm telling you is I don't have the financial means to fly around the country and set up shop and wait for the side of a mountain to open up. But if those who go there see it open up, take a picture of it. Take several pictures of it.
Actually, there is pictures which they're on a website.
Send me that evidence, please.
I took some daytime photos too. I took daytime photos. I got three in daylight above the mountain. But the night vision, I haven't taken any photographs. But I can ask.
But you have photos of the door opening up?
No, I have pictures.
I don't personally. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Brooks.
Well, that's what we need, because until and unless there's evidence, then it just remains hearsay or anecdotal accounts. But if it is physically happening, then it should be feasible to get physical evidence of that, and that's what I would like to see.
I totally respect the investigatory process, and we do it the same here on this program.
It's part of the scientific process. If something is happening, then scientific methodology demands empirical proof.
Right.
Actually, can you give out your website? And
I don't have a website, but Brooks, haven't you linked to my page at Keyhole Publishing?
Yes, I put the Amazon link up at X Squared Radio, and if you'll send the information to me, I can send it on to Richard. I'm not going to give out his email address on the air. And I've got some evidence. You know, I'm not a ufologist at all, but I shot some daytime photographs that are very high resolution. And at the same time that I was shooting, there was someone standing next to me shooting with another camera, and they photographed exactly the same ship that I got.
Yeah. But as far as to go back to bases, I know for a fact that the entire island of Manhattan has underground network tunnels, and I know this for a fact because as a kid growing up, there was always fallout shelters. And in case for the people out there that don't know what this looks like, it's a yellow and black sign with three triangles three black triangles and three yellow triangles. And all the schools had them, and they took them all down in the 90s, and they closed off these tunnels. And I've seen these tunnels myself go into any building built before the 1960s had these tunnels. And also there was a church called St. John the Divine that went down three stories, which I was able to go down two stories. And then as a teenager, got arrested for being in places I shouldn't be in this church.
Sounds cool.
Yeah. But anyway, so I know these facilities do exist because I know the entire island of Manhattan and the Gambino crime family used to use them for heroin runs. And from what I was told from the old timers, they used to keep guns and food in that place in case the Germans did invade the United States. The population can go underground and fight off the Germans.
Wow.
And then later it was the Russians because it was made for nuclear fallout.
Well, there you go.
True. That's true. These types of facilities are beneath many cities all across the country, but what I'm discussing with my research goes well beyond that, far greater in scope, far more technologically sophisticated, and far deeper, going down thousands of feet, even a mile or more. As one of my expert sources told me quite clearly, to make a major manned underground base 1 mile deep is child's play for modern civil engineering.
Wow. That's really something.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I saw was on the History Channel UFO hunters. They were searching on underground sea bases, and what they did, they never had any hard proof, but what they did find that intrigued me was that this military base had these huge wires going down on the side of this reef going down thousands of miles. Not thousands of miles. I don't know how many miles. But they showed it going down, but they obviously didn't follow it all the way down. So that to me was proof. And this was off either Bermuda Islands or St. Thomas. I can't remember the exact island. Are you familiar with that?
Well, hello? There is a place in the Bahamas called Altec.
Yes, that's it.
And this for a long time has been a place where the Navy has tested deep undersea systems and equipment. In fact, I've been told that at one time there was a underground facility on in the Bahamas for President Kennedy. This was back in the 1960s. So for a long time, the United States government has had a secret presence there and has had a facility at great depth.
Yeah, they actually show that
they do very deep. They do very deep underwater testing there of their systems, not just hundreds of feet deep, but thousands of feet deep. They have equipment for testing the weapon systems and so forth. So that is a very deep base. I don't know the extent of it, but Altec has been there for a long time. AUTEC is the acronym. Mm-hmm.
For the last two callers who were kind of in denial, I just want to say something as simple as like the History Channel did something on bunkers and did show the Washington, D.C. bunker and what it looked like and how many people were housed and how it worked and everything. They didn't show the Pentagon one or the other ones, but they showed several bunkers, and they showed the one for JFK as well.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, those would have been facilities from half a century ago. What exists today is far bigger, far deeper, far more sophisticated.
Well, the reason why I'm mentioning it, and I agree with you 100%, the reason why I mention it is if they showed that, it's just like when they show they declassify a plane or they show an underground base, you know that for a fact they got something way better if they're showing that. That's out of date.
Yeah, that's PlayStation 2. And PlayStation 4 is already out, on the test bench.
Exactly. So that's the reason why I'm bringing that up is to kind of help give you more credence on your work. I don't think I need to help you though. But.
Well, not only that, Ramon, we got several trillion dollars that are missing.
Oh, they're under my bed.
Yeah.
That's why I moved to Japan.
Yeah, I'm with you. Well, we're at the top of the hour, Ramon. I need to take a quick break, let people get a glass of water, our affiliates to do their thing, and then we'll be back with the final hour.
I'll let somebody else call in the next hour, and thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Ramon. That was Ramon, our good friend from Japan. He's teaching English there. Listen, we'll take a quick break, 5 minutes at the most, and we'll be right back with more Richard Sauter. Don't go away. And welcome back to X Squared Radio. A little Muse, the song Uprising off their Resistance album. Just thought it was appropriate. Listen, if you're thinking about buying the book Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, which just came out in print this week on Amazon, I applaud you. Good choice. Go there and buy the book. If you're wanting to still buy the ebook, you can do it for one more week. Go to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Buy the ebook. You get 25% off of the printed version. You will also get the audio version sent to you for free. So we appreciate you patronizing and helping us out there. Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, now out in print. Our guest tonight is Richard Sauder. We are talking about the absolute evidence that there are underground bases, not only in the United States, not only controlled by the United States, but all over the world. Now, it takes a lot of engineering, it takes a lot of work, it takes a lot of money to build these. And lots of corporations involved in it, which I'm sure is creating jobs for some people. But the money that it takes to build these facilities is disappearing out of our gross national product, out of our societies, out of our economies globally. And we are not gaining the benefits from it, unless you think that survival of the human race might be a collective benefit. In this hour, we're going to talk a little bit about maybe a little bit beyond that. We'll crack open the idea that maybe we have, in addition to burying ourselves deep in the earth with very highly sophisticated high-tech bases, there's also another space program. Welcome back, Richard.
Thank you, Brooks.
Richard, tell us about your book a little bit, how people can buy it, and then we'll get to our callers.
Well, they can, of course, buy my books from Amazon.com, Hidden in Plain Sight Beyond the X-Files, and then my other book is The Richard Sauder Briefing. They can also go to my publisher's website, keyholepublishing.com, and my several of my books are for sale there. There is a link there for my books. Now, and what was the second part of your question, Brooks?
I just was asking people, asking you to tell people how to get a hold of your book, and you told us. Are you going to be speaking anywhere this fall?
You know, I'm not currently scheduled to speak anywhere. I am rarely asked to speak. I'm doing a lot of traveling this fall in September, October, and November. And after I'm through traveling, I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing and where I will settle. But in the interim, I'm traveling, I'm doing interviews, and learning a great deal about this country and the world. Having a lot of fun, actually, and seeing things, some countryside that I hadn't seen for a long time, and in some cases, ever.
Great.
So that's been very fascinating.
Awesome. Well, it's a good time for it. I think we're enjoying, economically vacuous times here in the U.S. Small business is really having a hard time getting going. Interestingly enough, before we get to our caller, we have Scott in Florida on the line, and I'll bring him on in just a second. I was really encouraged when President Bush said, we're going back to the moon by 2020. I was a big fan of the moon program and exploring the moon, and I thought that there were great commercial possibilities there, not just for the space program, but for mining and for astronomy and, you know, just being 250,000 miles out from the Earth on a stable body with gravity. You could make water and oxygen, and it just seemed so common sense and so unrealistic that we hadn't been back there since 1972. Then Obama became president and he said, nope, no more man travel. If we go back to space, we're going to hitch a ride with somebody else. And I thought to myself, what does he know that we don't know? Why in the world would anyone in this modern day say no more manned space travel? What's going on, Richard?
Well, I can't tell you exactly, but I can tell you some of the things that my research indicates. Again, I don't work for any agency. I'm not on the inside of any compartmentalized program, never have been, don't expect to ever be. But two things I think at least are happening. There's deep lore from a lot of researchers who've looked into the space program and related issues suggesting that when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin first went to the moon back in, I guess it was July of 1969, that there were others there with a superior technology, and that essentially NASA was warned away from the moon by others. Who those others are, I couldn't say. I do find it interesting that NASA went to the moon just a few times, you know, for to drop in, to scoop up some rocks and scoop right back to Earth. They were scoop and scoop missions. And then it all ended in the early 1970s, and we haven't been back since. In fact, all of the rockets were dismantled. NASA no longer has the ability to go to the moon, even if NASA wanted to go to the moon. And right now, NASA doesn't want to go to the moon. So it all went away as soon as it began. And as you rightly observe, why? So that's part of it. The other part is that my research indicates NASA is probably not the only space program, and that from the very beginning, starting in the 1950s, there has been a parallel secret space program. Now, it is true that Neil Armstrong came to NASA from the Dinosaur program. Dinosaur is spelled D-Y-N-A hyphen S-O-A-R. Dinosaur was a manned space program that was started by the United States Air Force in the 1950s. And the Air Force had its own parallel astronaut corps, parallel to the astronaut corps developed by NASA. The Air Force, in about 1963 or something like that, announced that it was abandoning its manned Dinosaur space program, which was designed to put astronauts into orbit, just like the Mercury program, with a space plane somewhat resembling a smaller version of the space shuttle. And Dinosaur actually was developing the hardware and training astronauts to do this. But then the Air Force announced it shut down that program, and Neil Armstrong then went from the Dinosaur military astronaut program over to NASA's manned space program, and ultimately was the first man to step onto the moon, or so we're told. Then in the 1960s, the United States military developed a second manned space program, which they called MOL, Manned Orbiting Laboratory, and the idea was that the U.S. military would have a parallel Earth orbiting program parallel to the Gemini program, which at the same time during the mid-1960s was intended to orbit astronauts. In about 1966 or so, the military announced that it wasn't going to do the MOL program after all, and that it was going to shut it down. So that was the second military manned space program that they announced they were shutting down. Ostensibly, they never put astronauts up. And this happened a third time in the late 1980s, about 1987, 1989, something like that. The military announced for a third time that it had developed, parallel to the NASA manned space program, a manned space program of its own, and they announced they had a 32-astronaut, secret astronaut corps in Los Angeles, that they were disbanding, and that they were going to have a parallel space shuttle program, parallel to the space shuttle program that NASA has, and that they had developed a separate launch facility at Vandenberg Air Force Base, complete with their own mission control facility for monitoring and tracking the military space shuttle while it was in orbit. But in 1989, the United States military announced that they were shutting that program down and disbanding their 32-man top-secret astronaut corps. So three times the American military that we know of, that we can document, developed hardware in an astronaut corps separate from that of NASA, but three times announced that it wasn't going to do it after all and was shutting the programs down. I find this most strange, Brooks. In my
opinion, I do too. I, you know, we had that little miniature. We had a little miniature space shuttle program that NASA was working on, and they just kind of lost funding and lost interest, and then the Air Force picked it up, shoved it into their rapid deployment program, and lo and behold, the XB-37 or X-37B launched out on a 9-month mission. Nobody knows what it's doing up there.
Yeah, and there have been some other of these boost glide types of technologies that we've been told are unmanned, but I humbly submit to you that you can easily put an astronaut into some of these vehicles and put him into space. It's not hard at all. I strongly suspect that, in fact, these programs are used as covers for development of technology and secret astronaut corps. And then when they were detected or came to public knowledge, that they were just shut down. But everyone knows, in fact, it's common knowledge that the military agencies have hundreds of black projects, compartmentalized projects, and I would wager that what happened is that these programs just continued secretly under a different name.
I don't know how common knowledge it is, but we do have a caller on the line from Florida, and he's a regular, and he might know. Scott, are you there?
Impact that it will have on Brevard County, which is south of where I am, in terms of if NASA is canceling its moon mission. We're talking about thousands of jobs, are we not, for the Ares rocket that are possibly not going to be replaced by something else.
Well, NASA already has canceled the moon missions back in the 1970s. The Saturn program was shut down totally, and there were no more missions to the moon, so that's already happened decades ago.
Well, there was the discussion of one during the Bush administration that we were going to go back to the moon by 2020, and I'm sure some money got funneled down there. And just recently, Obama went down there to try to save some votes, and he gave, what was it, Scott, $6 million or $6 billion to, no, I think it was $6 million
yeah.
or $600 million to NASA to try to patch things up for the Orion program.
Yes. And I also wanted to confirm that which Richard is talking about here in terms of there was an interview with Bob Dean done by Dolores Cannon on her radio show. She's also BBS. About 2 years ago, Bob Dean is retired military, and he was talking about the same thing that Richard's talking about tonight in terms of where the bases are located, one off the coast of Puerto Rico, some in the desert in Australia, and basically he said that all of Nevada is a base underneath it. Stories about UFOs hovering over a military base with warheads and causing havoc there. A lot of stories that he had experienced perhaps himself or heard stories of other people telling him. I was just curious if, with the imagination of Irwin Allen in the 60s coming up with Time Tunnel, which was an underground facility in the Arizona desert, I believe, that, and then along came the Philadelphia experiment and all these other things. Richard, do you think that the time travel or the like is part of the experiment that's going on underground in some of the facilities?
Well, that's the rumor that you will hear in some quarters. personally, I do believe that there have been technological breakthroughs on time research. I know that National Institute of Standards and Technology does a lot of research into time. For example, they have physicists who specialize in the study and measurement of time. I suspect that time can be engineered. You know, there was a lot of breakthroughs made in electromagnetic research and electrogravitic research in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. T. Townsend Brown and others had some very important findings. It seems that the time-space continuum can be engineered, can be massaged, and one of the ways to do it is with high-energy electromagnetic fields or high-energy electrical fields, and also with extremely rapidly rotating technologies. And if for some reason this forks or bends or twists the local time-space field with novel effects and distortions. I'm not a physicist. I'm not an electrical engineer, so I can't speak with any specificity of this. In addition, I reiterate, I have not worked on the inside of any compartmentalized projects that deal with these technologies, but from the totality of what I have seen, what I've read, and of what I've been told, it'd be my educated guess that that has happened and is going on.
Well, we've had Andy Basciago on this program before, who was ostensibly involved in the Pegasus project as a boy with his father, who worked in that level of...
I understand that, and I've heard his interviews at length, and I must say, with respect to what Mr. Basciago has said, he has provided not one shred of documentation to support his claims. And I must say, from the standpoint of science, if you're going to make claims, you must provide empirical proof. He has spectacularly failed to do that, beyond his say-so.
Well, I understand. It's easy to go, for instance, use things like the Bible code and say, oh, it predicted 9/11. But the prediction was actually written after 9/11 happened. So, you know, it's easy to go back and say that we predicted this and we predicted that. But if you've got it in print, if it's copyrighted and it's out there and it's before the event actually happens and then it happens, now you have independent proof that you've actually seen forward in time. That's something that is documentable. I agree with you.
And with extraterrestrial contact possibly here on Earth with others, and we don't know it, Bob Dean had mentioned that possibility when he was being interviewed. I had one experience where I felt that I was standing beside someone who turned to look at me, and I felt a coldness about the encounter, that I felt that I was being looked at by someone from another planet. It was just a sense of coldness. And what was going on here in town was that we were having a science convention for 2 weeks, and there was a mass influx of people from other countries here. I did hear this person speak, and it sounded kind of like Jim Neighbors doing Gomer Pyle once he spoke. But, I mean, it just, you know, the feeling tone that I got prior to hearing him talk was that I was being looked at by someone from another planet. It was just a very cold feeling, and I am empathic. I'm a counselor by nature, and that was just the sense I was getting, was that it was, you know, just as though I was being looked at by someone from another world.
Very interesting. I don't necessarily think that every one of those experiences would be cold, but if that particular one was, then I totally understand it. So, Richard, I got to ask you this question. We got parallel space programs, at least one parallel, maybe two parallel space programs. Do you think we're running regular missions, or at least running missions back and forth to Mars or the Moon or to other worlds that the public doesn't know about?
Yes. Let me tell you, in my research on underground bases, I have found multiple references in the mining engineering literature to plans for mining on both the moon and Mars for subsurface mining. These came from a variety of agencies such as NASA and the old Bureau of Mines, which no longer exists, but I think it was gotten rid of during the Reagan administration. But,
we ran a story last week. Let's see. It was from Space News, actually, and it was on asteroid mining. Yeah, it was a Plymouth Rock asteroid mission.
So you find this in the scientific and engineering literature. Beyond that, I would say that Ben Rich, who was the director of the famous Lockheed Skunk Works for many years, not long before he retired, or just after, said quite plainly on one occasion when he was making a presentation to the Engineering Alumni Association at UCLA, that we, meaning in this case the military-industrial complex, the American military-industrial complex, now have the technology to take ET home. In other words, flying saucer-like or UFO-like technology. Mm. He said that some equations had been modified or solved that permitted an engineering breakthrough. And then finally, I would say that the English hacker Gary McKinnon, who the United States government is attempting to extradite and imprison in the United States for 70 years in federal prison, broke into some federal computer systems, military and scientific, NASA and military computers, where he saw evidence for an extraterrestrial space fleet in which there were American off-world officers. And he's been outspoken about this in general terms, not in any specificity, but he has said that much. And I don't doubt that he did see what he claims he saw, and I don't doubt that that is why the United States government is making such a strong effort to bring this man to the United States and put him.
Yeah, I think if they extradite him, we're never going to see him again. Honestly, I think if they just left him alone, he's going to nuke himself with his publicity tactics. I just don't think he's coming across very credible. Maybe at first he was, but you know, the more attention that they spend on him, the more money they spend trying to extradite him, the more they elevate his celebrity status.
Well, he's not really a celebrity. This is a man who's been reduced to nothing. He doesn't have any money. He has had tremendous legal expenses and is really living under a tremendous amount of anxiety, dread, and fear with this potential 70-year prison sentence hanging over his head, which would effectively be a death sentence because he's in his 40s. So I really don't think that he's a celebrity. He certainly doesn't consider himself a celebrity. He's a frightened man who's had the full force of the United States government brought down on his head. I have heard what he had to say, and I think he's, to my mind, he's credible. He's an ordinary Joe, so to speak, who got caught with his digital fingers in the American government cookie jar and put his hands on one of the deep secrets, which is there is a secret space program, evidently a large one that we have not been told about. And to answer your question, yes, I do think that the secret space program is going back and forth to the moon and to Mars. And I think that's one of the reasons that NASA has not gone back, because there is better technology for going to the moon than chemical rockets.
Sure. Yeah, I have to agree with that. I know people that have worked on the ion drives, and we've had that since the days of Eisenhower. We've had ion drives. We could make faster ships, but we don't really need a fast ship to go to the moon. I mean, that's like backyard stuff now. We did that with tube technology and a digital watch for a computer in the spacecraft.
I'm not talking about speed here. I'm talking about heavy lift capability. For lifting heavy equipment and machinery to the moon, for example, chemical rockets are extremely inefficient.
Oh, sure.
If you had an electrogravitic lift, then that would be much more economical. And from what I can see, that is the most likely candidate and would probably be flying out of places like Pine Gap in Australia, Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, going out of Area 51 in the dark of night, or from White Sands Missile Range in the dark of night, those kinds of places, and without using chemical rockets.
And the chances of an amateur with a telescope picking up one of these heavy lift vehicles out in space would be pretty slim. I mean, you have to know when the International Space Station's coming over, and then you put your telescope on it and take a photograph. We see those all the time on spaceweather.com and various other websites, but no one has actually taken a photograph of one of these other ships yet.
Well, unless they're the triangles. Many people have photographed the triangles, for example, and many people have seen them. These huge triangles that are oftentimes, 100 yards or more on a side, sometimes hundreds of yards on a side, and certainly many, many people have seen them. They're black. They clearly do not use chemical rocket propulsion or any type of conventional aerospace power plant that we see in the public eye these days. And they have charcoal black, so something like that lifted off in the middle of the night and went up into the blackness of space. The chances for anyone seeing it, even if they were only a few miles away, are pretty slim.
Yeah, and they wouldn't have to travel very fast, just very quietly.
Oh, yeah, even if you were only going, 1,000 miles per hour, you could lift off very slowly, and once you get in the upper atmosphere, you could go faster and faster, and of course in deep space you could go many thousands of miles per hour. And even if it took you a week or two to get to the moon, so what? People spend a week crossing the Atlantic Ocean on an ocean liner. That's no problem.
Yeah, that's what I say too. So now, if this mining operation is going on the moon, I would suspect that there are lots of people working up there. You got to have support staff. You got to have medical people. You got to have engineers and mechanics. You got to have people that work on environmental controls and chemists.
Well, a lot of it could be automated, Brooks.
Well, yeah, I could see that, where you take crews up that are multi-skilled, and then they accomplish one task and then they come back. But eventually, you're going to want to build some kind of base there. And it's so convenient in the sense that one side of the moon always faces the Earth. All you have to do is slip around the other side of the moon and you can do anything you want to do. You'll never be seen from Earth.
Well, even on this side of the moon, even if there were a base on this side of the moon, who's going to see it?
Well, it's only 250,000 miles away, and there are a lot of digital...
Well, but I'm saying, if there's a mining base and 99% of it is underground, who's going to see it? And if you're mining underground, your equipment would be underground, your personnel would be underground. There really would be no one to see. Astronomers don't have the resolution with Earth-based telescopes to go down to, a couple hundred feet across or less than that.
Was this not the vision of Arthur C. Clarke in 2001 with a moon base?
Pardon me?
Sure. It's always science fiction writers that make the first forays into space, of course.
I do believe there's at least one clandestine moon base, and quite likely more. And I also suspect that it would be multinational, probably with representation from the Russians, the Americans, the Europeans, the Chinese, the Japanese, etc. I have a sinking feeling, Brooks, that we have been so massively lied to that
even the ones of us who suspect some portions of the truth will be astonished if and when all of it comes forth.
Well, it's pretty well known, it has been known for a long, long time, that the nation that controls the moon will control Earth. That's why we had a race to get there first anyway. But as you described, we spent all that money and all that national goodwill, and we went up there, and we scooped some rocks, and we came home. That was hardly the level of glory that I think the American people wanted to accomplish. And leaving two perfectly good launch engines sitting on the launch pad for 30 years and then dismantling them during the time is just a complete violation of the faith in the American way that got us there in the first place. I have to agree with you. I think we've been lied to.
Most people don't know that the United States Army had a plan to make dozens of moon missions using the same technology that NASA had to go back again and again and again and to build a base there and to have a permanent manned presence. And then in the early 1970s, all of that was shelved. That was the fourth military space program that I found evidence for. And that was also shelved at the same time that NASA shelved the Saturn moon program. So what happened? Something happened in the 1969 to 1972, 73 time frame, and it was all shut down. Bam. And, I mean, shut down and scrapped.
That's true. That's true. You know, my industrial technology instructor when I was in college was a former NASA engineer. He was part of that brain trust. And he told me, you know, Brooks, we had the most marvelous cross-dimensional brain trust ever assembled on the planet. He really believed that. He said we could have solved any problem the world had. And to let us all go, to just lay us off and say, that's it, you know, we accomplished the goal, we achieved the dream, there's nothing else to do, you all can go home now, was just, you know, a travesty of intelligence.
Well, it suggested the puppet masters behind the power structure in this country, at least, and perhaps elsewhere, were threatened by that and did not want the problems facing this planet solved. It suggests that it implies that they prefer a planet in chaos. They prefer a planet at war with itself. They prefer a planet with poverty. They prefer a planet with industrial pollution and contamination. They prefer a problem with an ecological crisis and collapse. And so they shut all that down because they didn't want the problems resolved, and they were threatened by the intellectual power of those power and promise, bright promise of that brain trust, if you will.
Well, for sure, not just that brain trust, but I think we had a generation, almost a global generation, of thinkers and travelers and explorers and dreamers and engineers that was coming on strong. I just remember in the early 70s, late 60s, the economy was doing things it had never done before. We were booming like nothing ever on this planet. The Roaring Twenties paled in comparison. And the whole world was doing this. And it seemed like, you know, right after Nixon was removed from office and Carter got in, it was like hot wax was just poured on everything. Everything came to a grinding halt. We saw gasoline and fuel shoot through the roof. We saw nationalization of fuel reserves. We saw OPEC formed. It was a horrible time for the planet, and we're still not over it.
Well, it went much deeper than Carter. You have to understand that all presidents are puppets of the hidden power structure. Nixon was, Ford was, Carter was, Lyndon Baines Johnson was, Kennedy was to a lesser degree, and that's why he had his brains blown out. he yanked back on the puppet string, and so the power brokers behind the scenes decided to make a scarecrow out of him and said, we'll blow the brains out of this one, so the other ones will bend to our will.
Yeah. Well, it does seem like that, because one of the pieces that we recorded here, we actually found an old recording of him, a very rare recording, and he was very poignant in this recording, and he was talking about secret organizations that really don't have the best interest of the American people or the people of Earth in mind.
That's right.
And
he was talking about a secret power. And
yes.
Not long after that, he had his brains blown out.
I'd never heard that speech before. I'd never heard that speech before, so we researched it out, and we played it on the air, and it was chilling. It was chilling.
Yes. Well, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, not long before he left office, gave the famous speech in which he warned the nation against the danger and the growing power of what he called the military-industrial complex. And he said, this is something new in our history. It's large, it's powerful, and it poses a threat to our system if it's not kept under control. And many people then didn't understand what he was saying. Many people today don't even remember that he said that. And if they do, still dimly, or barely understand what he was saying. But in his own way, he was also warning about this. And, of course, he was not heeded. Kennedy had his brains blown out, and we are where we are today.
Well, people have to remember, too, that Dwight D. Eisenhower was president. But before that, he was general. He knew what the military complex was capable of. He was part of the Pentagon crowd. He understood it.
He was Supreme Allied Commander during World War II.
That's exactly right. So he knew what we were capable of doing. He knew the military forces that were gaining power and had their hands on a budget that they could never dream about 50 years before then. And they weren't going to let it go.
You have to understand also that during the Eisenhower administration, there was a frantic program of underground base construction. There's a book written by Bill Gulley entitled Breaking Cover. And in that book, Bill Gulley, who was associated with the there's a military office in the White House, and that has an unlimited slush fund, and this goes back decades to the 50s at least, and probably before. All modern presidents have had access to this unlimited amount of money. It's a presidential slush fund that's unaccountable, and they can call on it to do almost anything they want at all, anywhere, for any reason. And Bill Gulley worked in this military office under Eisenhower, under Kennedy, under Johnson, and also under Nixon up into the Carter administration, first part of the Carter administration. Now, he said that already in the 50s, there were something like 75 deep underground facilities that were built for presidential use alone. So that was just part of the deep underground construction program in the 1950s alone. So you can see, going back more than half a century, there's been a massive ongoing program of deep underground construction of all kinds of installations and facilities. And that was for the White House.
Yeah. Well, we've covered it really thoroughly tonight, and we even understand generally why. Because it's not as though they want to go underground because it's going to rain. They want to go underground because something they know about is going to happen on the surface, or they suspect is going to happen on the surface. And they want the command and control and what they call priority personnel, I suppose, these Jeep people, to survive. So that, you know, once the smoke clears, or whatever it is they expect is going to wipe out the surface dwellers, whether it's weapons of mass destruction that are biological, nuclear, or even a surface cataclysm of some kind, like a solar flare, they're going to someday crawl out of their protected environment and literally restart the world.
Except that it won't work that way, and I would say again, that is only one reason, and only one reason for some of the underground facilities. That's just part of the picture. But beyond that, I would say I provide extensive documentation in my Hidden in Plain Sight book for plans already in the Kennedy and Johnson administration back in late 1963, early 1964, for building a so-called DUCC under Washington D.C. And this would have been 3,500 feet deep. And by the way, I believe something like that certainly has been made, and I give the reasons for why and more documentation in my book. But there were to have been high-speed elevators accessing the 3,500-foot level underground from the White House, from the State Department, and from the Pentagon. And the idea was that in the event of a nuclear war, certain leading figures from the military and the government would go down underground. That's two-thirds of a mile underground. And that topside, the Chinese, the Russians would have been sending in multi-megaton warheads, 3 megaton, 5 megaton, and repeated salvos, such that nothing would be left alive topside for 100 miles in either direction.
Yeah.
So under that scenario, if you're 3,500 feet underground and everything has been exterminated topside, what are you going to rule over when you come out?
Exactly right. My point exactly. And how are you going to communicate with the world?
And how will you live? How will you survive if everything has been sterilized and is radioactive as far as the eye can see? The acronym for the military policy in that era, as I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, was MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. So what is even the point of that? It is madness. It is insanity, and yet we essentially operate under the same policy to this day. We still have the hundreds of nuclear missiles. We have the nuclear missile firing submarines. We still have the B-52 bombers that Stanley Kubrick described in his Dr. Strangelove movie over half a century ago. We still have those B-52s today, and they're still armed with nuclear missiles and nuclear bombs.
I was stationed at that B-52 base. I know exactly what they're talking about there.
More than half a century has gone by, and what's changed?
Well, I hope a lot has changed. I hope that our ability to communicate globally on programs like this and others, I hope that our ability to talk to one another instantaneously around the planet, share our ideas and dissolve our differences, I hope that a lot has changed. I hope that 21st century humanity has a different idea of the future.
Except, Brooks, as we speak, we have bombed the hell out of Iraq. We have killed 1 million Iraqis. We have caused 4 million more to become refugees. We have just bombed and bombed and bombed in Afghanistan. We're on the verge of going to war against Iran. We're still pointing nuclear missiles at various Tom, Dicks, and Harrys all over the planet. We are still sailing our aircraft carrier battle groups hither and thither. So how much has really changed?
Well, I was thinking on a social level. You know, I sort of ascribe to that 1960s...
Well, on a social level, our economy is imploding right now. We actually have levels of poverty now that we had in the early 60s. When Lyndon Johnson phased in his war on poverty, his Great Society program.
I know. Eastern Kentucky is now sporting a 25% unemployment rate. 25%. This area has not seen that kind of unemployment ever, even during the Depression. Eastern Kentucky
worked. One out of every eight people in this country is now on food stamps.
That's what I'm saying, Richard. Where did the money go? Where did the money go? All the money can't be gone. There's got to be some money flowing in the system.
Well, I'm telling you, less and less of it is flowing all the time. This is a takedown of the American people by the American government.
Well, we've never actually had a conflict like this before, not in this country, maybe in other countries, where I don't want to see that kind of conflict come to its natural conclusion. I think we can do this because in our country, we have a constitution. We have a thing called a vote. And we can go fire them all. All we have to do in November.
Happened, Brooks. It hasn't happened, Brooks, and the elections are rigged. I think you're remembering what you were taught in your high school civics class maybe half a century ago or 30 or 40 years ago. But I'm sorry, Brooks, the system doesn't work that way. It's rigged. It is criminally rigged by two cooperating criminal syndicates named the Democratic Party and the Republican Party.
Well, we believe you on this. We reported 2 weeks ago that there was a strange fire down in Texas where 10,000 voting machines and all the code-generating equipment mysteriously burned up. The fire started at 4:15 in the morning. No one was in the building. It was a warehouse. And it burned up all the voting machines. We have often said on this program, it's not the voting that determines the election. It's the counting that determines the election.
That's right. And the elections here are rigged, is what I'm telling you. And we've seen plenty of evidence for that in recent years.
Well, we certainly have. And, you know, I'm not going to speculate one way or the other as to who really won what presidential election. The idea is it was close. It was close because a lot of people have different ideologies of what to do in this country. We have an unprecedented population of professional voters in this country. That is to say, these are people who believe they have a paycheck coming from the government. And they believe that if they don't pull one handle or another, they're going to lose that check. That makes them a professional voter. It makes them have a conflict of interest. And in my mind, they shouldn't even have the right to vote because they're going to vote their pocketbook and they're not going to vote the public good.
Yes, and let me tell you how the elections are rigged. There are only two parties going back to the Civil War days, 150 years. There have only been two parties over and over again, and they alternate in power. First one, then the other, then the one, then the other, then the other, then the one, and back and forth and back and forth. And it's all arranged and rigged, beyond which the voting machines themselves are rigged.
You know what the bureaucracies in Washington call congressmen, especially freshman congressmen? They call them temps. That's what they call them.
Well, they get their money from political action committees, from PACs, and they vote as they are paid to vote.
Well, the ones that don't have no power. Richard, it's been an awesome program. I want to have you back because we have hours yet to talk, but we are out of time.
Thank you, Brooks. It's been a great experience. I've had fun.
Yeah, that's what we try to do here. And I had fun having you on, and we'll have you back on. Thank you. Thank you so much, Richard. You have a wonderful week. I wish you luck and success with what you've got going this week.
Thank you, Brooks. Thank you.
All right. Good night, sir. All right, Earth Explorers, wish us luck as we go to D.C. Tomorrow and Tuesday to talk about things business-wise with those that we have elected to office. And we've run a little bit over, but I think you guys deserved it. We'll be back next week with more X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.